And the great thing is ideas. And as I've always thought, ideas are the jumping off point of the imagination, but they're also the jumping off point of connection throughout humanity. Ideas are really what connect us all.
Welcome to the latest podcast in our Arts Research Africa dialogue series. These dialogues are intended to stimulate practice, enable research, and inspire collective engagement around the question of artistic research in Africa. I'm Prof. Christo Doherty, the Chair of Research in the Wits School of Arts. In this dialogue, I'll be speaking to Ariane Cook, a prominent British independent producer, curator, and writer, recognized globally for her pioneering work at the intersection of art and science. With a career spanning several decades, she's particularly noted for founding the Arts at CERN program, which she designed and directed from 2009 to 2015. This initiative was the first official international arts program at CERN and aimed to foster collaboration between artists and scientists. Under her leadership, the program included various residency opportunities for artists, allowing them to explore and interpret scientific concepts through their creative practices. Ariane's background includes a Claw Fellowship, which she undertook at CERN and the Imperial War Museum, as well as roles such as the National Director of the Avon Foundation for Creative Writing and an award-winning radio and television producer at the BBC. Her diverse experiences have informed her approach to curating and consulting, focusing on how art can communicate complex scientific ideas and engage the public in innovative ways. In addition to her work at CERN, Ariane has been active as a curator and producer of numerous international projects and exhibitions, such as Entangle, Physics and the Artistic Imagination, and Real Feelings, Emotion and Technology. She has also served on various juries for Art and Science Awards and has lectured widely on the subject of transdisciplinary practices. Her work emphasizes the importance of collaboration across disciplines, aiming to inspire new ways of thinking about the relationship between humanity and the natural world. Through her initiatives, she continues to influence the landscape of contemporary art and science, making significant contributions to cultural discourse. In this podcast, we focus on the Arts at CERN project, a curatorial and political challenge that Ariane launched single-handedly in 2010. CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, is an intergovernmental organization comprising 24 member states that operates the largest particle physics laboratory in the world, situated in a vast complex based outside Geneva in Switzerland. CERN's main function is to provide particle accelerators and other infrastructure needed for high-energy physics research. The lab's most notable project is the Large Hadron Collider, LHC, the world's largest and highest energy particle collider, consisting of a 27-kilometer ring of superconducting magnets. The center employs approximately 2,660 scientific, technical, and administrative staff members, and in 2019 hosted about 12,400 users from institutions in more than 70 countries. We do a deep dive into the experience of setting up the Arts at CERN program and the lessons Ariane learnt from working with artists and scientists in such a challenging context. We then go on to unpack Ariane's more recent insistence that we need to go beyond the acceptance of art-science collaborations as de facto positive and the implications of this insight for her current work as a producer and curator. Useful links to Ariane's website and many of her influential writings can be found in the show notes for this podcast. Ariane, welcome. It's a great pleasure and an honor to have you here on this latest Aura podcast. And I'm delighted to be able to congratulate you on the award last week, the Grand Jury Award at Ars Electronica for the Arts at CERN project, which you designed and initiated more than a decade ago. So it must be great pleasure for you to see that that project has legs and longevity and has continued to flourish. So great to see that and well done.
Yeah, it's a great joy that it has reached that peak of development and maturity now. Way back from when I first dreamt of it in 2009 and then was hired by CERN to actually implement my vision and create all the funding and everything, including the design of it. Yeah. So it's wonderful.
We'll look in detail at how you went about that project, Arts at CERN, later in this podcast, because I think it's really important and a valuable lesson for us here in South Africa and the southern parts of the world generally. So let's start with you. And what was your personal journey into art science curation? Because I note that you began with what looks like literature studies in university. You've been an award-winning radio and television journalist. So you've clearly traveled a path to get to where you're operating now in the realm of arts, science, technology, curation, and design.
Yes. Well, I think it all really links back to my love of physics, because I always really loved physics when I was young, but it also really links back to my studies at university. So while they may seem to be in literature, I was a specialist in Mary Shelley and Frankenstein. And what more amazing book on the planet is there which deals with art, science, and technology? And, you know, it's the most extraordinary book. Well, it was told originally as a tale in 1816 by the lake in Geneva, and in the middle of a thunderstorm, they were doing a story off together. It was her, Byron, Polidori, and the romantics just having this story off. And the 17-year-old girl won with this amazing story of the monster and the monster's creator, Frankenstein. That's kind of called the grim waking dream, as she called it. And for me, that has always been a kind of inspiration to me in so many ways, because it shows how the imagination works and can take us further into thinking about knowledge making and how the world and reality is formed. And the whole novel is about that. And it takes as its starting off point the science which was emerging at the time in looking at electricity as a form of creating beings and consciousness through the work of, for example, Giovanni Aldini or Sir Humphry Davy and Erasmus Darwin. They were all looking at electricity and seeing whether it had the potential to animate the dead and whether it was the vital connection between living matter and dead matter. And that's what Mary so brilliantly investigated with and through her imagination. So I've always been really interested in new places where knowledge is being made, where technology is advancing. So I think in the end, my journey to get to CERN was kind of inevitable with that seed, because CERN itself is close to Lake Geneva. But equally, it is a place which is on the forefront of knowledge and technology. So I think the seeds were probably sown way back then. It was like having a homecoming, being there. I felt instantly at home because that had always been inside my mind and imagination in a way through Mary Shelley.
But Mary Shelley's tale told to the romantics on the shores of Lake Geneva is certainly a warning. I mean, that's certainly how it's been adopted in the culture, even to a point that the monster is called Frankenstein rather than the inventor, the creator of the monster. It's been taken as a warning of technological hubris and the dangers, the monsters that are unleashed upon the world by science and technology. Whereas CERN seems to be almost entirely a project for the good that really seems to seek knowledge, abstract physics understandings, rather than the direct impact of technologies, experiments gone wrong, like Dr. Frankenstein's work with the monster.
Yeah, that's a super fair point, because CERN was also created to demonstrate the beauty of science and also how scientists can work together after the Second World War. It came out of the Second World War, really, as a way of uniting people towards showing that the creation of fundamental knowledge had a peaceful and positive effect on humanity. Everything from PDF files and mice trackers to MRI scans come out of the technology and knowledge which was formed at CERN.
The World Wide Web.
And the World Wide Web. We cannot forget that. But then you look at the World Wide Web and you could argue that Frankenstein has a place within that, very much so.
Definitely does. But as you were saying, certainly CERN had been around for a long time. It was established in 1954. And you came to CERN 2009, launched Arts at CERN from 2010 onwards. So a lot had been going on in CERN scientifically. And on the margins of CERN, there were several artists who visited CERN under their own initiative, everybody from Anselm Kiefer to Paul Greengrass and Robert Harris, I know, visited CERN in looking for different kinds of inspiration. But can you talk us through your involvement with CERN and how you went about conceptualizing and designing a project like Arts at CERN and the kind of challenges, which I think must have been many, particularly political and institutional, in getting such a project off the ground?
Oh my gosh, how long have you got? That's about a week's debrief. Yes, I mean, it's huge. And I've never really written about it. And I keep on thinking I should write about it because it's incredibly complex. Also, I ought to say that Anselm Kiefer came under my invitation. He didn't come on his own.
Oh, correction.
I think in the official thing which came out with the Starts Award, it said he came before Arts at CERN. He didn't. He came right at the end. He was practically my last guest artist in 2014. A wonderful curator, Kathleen Soriano, who's director of the Royal Academy, approached me and said, what about inviting Anselm? He's never been to CERN. So he came. So that was quite extraordinary.
You got a grant, and the grant gave you the opportunity to engage with CERN and conceptualize the project. Is that correct?
Yes. I won an award for cultural leadership for the work I did at the BBC and also director of a foundation for creative writing called the Avon Foundation. And at both those places, the primacy of the imagination had always been in my work, and also the primacy of knowledge and new knowledge making. So I was very well known for doing, for example, programs which explored art, science, technology, philosophy, and mixed everything up. So I've always been transdisciplinary. And I won this award, the Claw Fellowship, which is like a Kennedy scholarship. And they said I could go anywhere I liked in the world with it for 3 months, funded by the UK government. I was the UK government Department of Cultural, Media and Sport fellow. And I got offered amazing three-month attachments with big galleries like the Tate, with Creative Time in New York. And I turned them down. And everybody was like, why are you doing this? You've got these amazing places which want you. And this was part of the three-month attachment. And one day I did this cycle ride from my home to the British Library. And I cycled. Why have I turned down these amazing places? And as I cycled, I thought, oh, it's because I love places which are on the frontiers of knowledge. I want to use this 3 months to make a difference, to make something different happen, rather than follow and fill in behind people and be a passive observer. I want to be an active person who makes change happen. Because how many times in your life do you get the opportunity to have 3 months off to do something? And then I thought, what makes me weird, which is a very interesting question, which I always encourage people to think about. And what makes me weird is I love physics, very interested in nuclear physics, even though I'm against anything nuclear. Very interested in nuclear physics. I've made documentaries for the BBC on Chernobyl, for example, and the tests in the Australian desert. But I'd never gone subatomic. And then I remembered my friend Chris Drury, who's an amazing land artist. He had come back from Antarctica via CERN, and he had done an echogram of the ice in Antarctica and an echogram of the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, which, as you know, is the world's biggest machine, 26 kilometers in circumference, spans across France and Switzerland, where they recreate the beginning of the universe. And I remember him saying something amazing could happen at CERN. So by the time I got to the British Library, I was like, oh! And then I ran upstairs, and this is literally what happened, and Googled CERN plus art, and saw that Philip Glass had been commissioned to compose a music piece for the switching on of the first time of the LHC, and that artists had been going in and out of CERN, but there was no consistent program other than one which had been started with the London Institute, but it had come from outside, and it had been proposed by Ken McMullen, who drove this project, which was very beautiful and had involved kind of famous artists, but it came from the outside and was imposed in. And I thought, oh, something magical might happen. So I literally wrote a 10-page pitch there and then saying, you're at this great moment where you're going to switch on again. And physics really shaped the 20th century. And you're now in the 21st century, just about to find the Higgs boson. So that's going to cause another phenomenal cultural shift. But you can't call yourself a cultural force until you put in art. So science plus technology does not equal culture. It's art, science, technology equals culture. So I sent this email and pitch on the Friday, didn't know anybody. And then on the Monday, I got a reply saying, this is amazing. Our new director general really believes in science and society. And when can you start? And my mentor on the program went, oh, so you're flying out next weekend and you don't know where you're going or where you're going to sit or you don't know any of these people? And I went, yes, because I can feel that something might happen. So I went out for 3 months and did a feasibility study of looking at the possibility of creating an arts program at CERN and looked at what had happened in the past with the London Institute, with Ken McMullen's pioneering program, and interviewed artists who'd been involved in that to learn from them. I also tracked artists and scientists working together in different art forms. So looked at the Artists and Labs program in Switzerland, for example, and tracked one physicist with one artist there working together, and looked at art science collaborations worldwide. But most importantly of all, I looked at the people of CERN and how they worked and how they thought and how they operated and how their daily lives were. I looked at the place of CERN, what it's like. I mean, if you've ever been to CERN, you'll know that above ground, it's a shambles. It's got kind of old falling down kind of huts and very old 1950s architecture, though that's all got souped up now, thanks to the Science Gateway, which Renzo Piano designed so beautifully and has been installed. So you don't notice these other things. But below ground, you enter into a futuristic world like something you could never even imagine, where you see these machines, which are extraordinary. The detectors are as big as Notre Dame. So you look at these and realize the feats which human beings can do, which is sort of super important as well. And yeah. So people, place and culture are very, very important. And the culture of the place is very important, particularly the culture of physicists who are very collegiate. They work together, massive groups, like 3,000, 5,000 people working on a detector project together. They work in conciliation. And CERN was actually a model for the European Commission and the European Parliament. It was actually a model for it. So they work through consolidating and agreeing with ideas. So it makes you realise what you're working in. It's a community of people, a huge community of people. So looking at that, I investigated, for example, I interviewed a very famous artist who'd come in on the London Institute project. And I literally said to him, why did you make that really bad piece? Because he made a really bad piece. He's a phenomenal artist.
It's a great opening line.
Yeah. And he went, oh, I'm glad you spotted that. I did that actually as a statement because I was so angry. And what he was angry about was that there was no mediation. He was just dropped into the laboratory and he'd been promised lots of things like access to new technology, but nobody was responsible for him or introducing him to the scientists or discussing things, or there was no point of introduction and there was no point of follow-up either, which is what curation is. And curation is part of that, as well as act of translation. Sometimes you as a curator can find the people quicker. And it isn't just a matter of putting people inside the press office, because the press office are really, really busy. And they've got their own priorities, and an artist isn't a priority for them, although they're important and they do the best they can. But curators kind of know about ideas and how they link across disciplines. So Richard said, yeah, no, I did it. And I called it the ghost trap because I was so angry. So he said, what got me was we needed to be embedded within that community and not just flown in and flown out. And Richard's whole analysis was really helpful to me in forming Arts at CERN, as were the observations of the artist Keith Tyson, who'd been going in and out of CERN a lot as well. And he said to me, really, all we are knowledge explorers. We're explorers of knowledge, and that's our linking point. And the great thing is ideas. And as I've always thought, ideas are the jumping off point of the imagination, but they're also the jumping off point of connection throughout humanity. Ideas are really what connect us all.
One of the things that struck me about your program was how, certainly in my view, the time that the artists spend at CERN are relatively short. It's from 1 to 3 months. I mean, with 3 months, I think, being the longest duration. And if I compare it with the Swiss Artists and Labs program, that's been very much long duration residencies, up to 9 months. 9 months being certainly in the view of that program, the optimum length of time for an artist to really become embedded in a lab and really come to grips with the practices in the lab and the personalities. And that's certainly a model we followed here in Johannesburg at WITS. Why did you go for the shorter durations?
Yeah, the shorter duration is pragmatic and practical, I think. One of the things was I did track a physicist with an artist, and I discovered that the artist, after about a month or 2 months, started to want to become a physicist and then started creating work which was not like them at all and was starting to illustrate and describe the science. And I realized that particle physics in particular has this real draw for artists, and they do suddenly think, oh my God, I could become a particle physicist, in their minds, without unconsciously, because it's so overwhelmingly brilliant. It's all about the beginning of the universe and you just really want to grapple with it. So I literally extrapolated from that, that there was a danger in that. And I'm talking about somebody who was consistently working with particle physicists for a year, actually. He was in the lab every day. So his work became very reductive, became very illustrative. And that's not what I was looking for. Equally, I was really determined that the artist should be paid and paid a salary and also have all their accommodation, food, travel paid for. So the artist was paid 5,000 Swiss francs a month. So they were paid a salary, and that all needs to be fundraised. And each artist costs 60,000 Swiss francs for 3 months, all inclusive. So that was costed. And I was the one who was going to be fundraising for it. No one else. There was no one else fundraising. I was totally responsible. So that's another pragmatic thing. And also the other thing was there was just me. It's also the other practical thing. There was just me there doing the program at the beginning. implementing it, designing it, creating it, fundraising it, communicating it, branding it, pitching it, writing the press releases, working with Ars Electronica, creating the festival, which we created together in 2011, which was dedicated to CERN and had discussions and talks attached to it, where we also announced and launched the Collide residency open calls for Geneva and internationally as well, because Ars Electronica were the international partners at the beginning for the first 3 years. And the city and canton of Geneva were the partners for the first 3 years of the Geneva Prize for the Collide residency. So the Collide residency was always 3 months and always has been and continues to this day as being that. The other program I brought in, the Accelerate, was a 1 month research program, which is the one you just referred to. And then, of course, there were the day long visiting artist programs, or guest artists as they're called, which can be just a day, which are heavily curated introductions. And they have created incredible impact. So, for example, the Polish artist Gosia Macuga created an extraordinary tapestry based just off her visit, which was shown in Documenta. Iris van Herpen created a whole fashion collection called Magnetic Motion, which came out of her one-day visit, which I curated. Anselm Kiefer paid homage to his one-day visit to CERN when he came in 2014. And when I teased him saying, I know you create underground structures in France, but maybe this structure is even bigger than the ones you're creating. And he laughed and said yes, and then referred to it in the big prize that he got awarded at the end of 2014. Yeah, so that's a way of saying that actually if you curate things well and properly, it can have a really great impact even one day if you have that proper curation, which is like an act of translation, introductions, encouragements, follow-ups, discussions, which continue, production ideas, sharing of ideas. And equally, as I've just said, the 3 months was a pragmatic way of making sure the artist didn't turn a kind of turtle and start wanting to become a physicist.
Okay. You've also described the design of the program as a provocation. And I think that's linked to the fact that you deliberately didn't require any tangible outputs from the artists participating in the program. And that, to me, is particularly fascinating because certainly here in South Africa, very difficult to get funding without promising some sort of tangible output to the funders, in our case, university or government funders. Can you talk more about that approach to designing a program like this as a deliberate provocation?
Yes, with delight. It was a political provocation because I'd got really fed up with the fact that artists are kind of being turned into production animals and are told to kind of come up with an idea and then produce it within a given timescale. And I made Arts at CERN as a deliberate provocation against that and as a political statement. One, because I think an artist exists to create and make, so they always make something. You don't need to say, you will make something in X time, because they always will make something. Number two, with proper curation, with somebody on the ground, encouraging and holding the space, but also helping them with production, it will happen at some point. And number three, an idea takes as long as it takes. And also number four, I really believe in the process. And I think that's where the magic happens, the process between encountering new technologies and new ideas, the kind of void there is in terms of knowledge, which again was why I created the program, so that artists had this kind of formal space where they could jump into the unknown, have me with them by their side, holding them at some point when they kind of were like, oh my God, what's Wimpzilla? What's this? What on earth's going on? How am I going to cope? I mean, I always remember Gilles Jobin going, oh my God, I have no idea what's going on. And I was like, that's fine. You're a dancer. Your way of knowing is through your body. So respond through your body. How is your body feeling? What's your body sensing? Just respond in your way of knowing, because it's all about different ways of knowing, meeting each other. So I was creating that open space for that to happen. And then I was very lucky because I was able to persuade people of the magic of the process, that private philanthropists came on board and funded the residency because they believed in what I was saying. And then the city and canton of Geneva did, and Ars Electronica did. And they could see what I was saying about these kind of creative collisions between different worlds and ways of knowing.
Congratulations. I think that's an admirable way to design the program. You mentioned Geneva. Part of the politics of your organizing the arts at CERN was also linking CERN with the city of Geneva. Because as I understand it, CERN was seen as quite an alien, other kind of a place by people living in Geneva. And you've used the arts program to actually open up lines of understanding and dialogue between CERN as a science facility and the city and townsfolk of Geneva?
Yes, that's another layer. And that's what I mean about the complexity of setting up this program, because it works on so many different layers. So one of the layers is that strategic layer of thinking about the positioning of CERN. And CERN was seen as this kind of remote monastery of slightly crazy people who had this giant machine. So strategically, I could see that there would be the need of creating a stronger link. And what better way than creating something different through an arts program, which would link it? And I made the case for that with the city of Geneva, talking about how Geneva has this extraordinary history in terms of the history of science, for example, and also in terms of the history of art, and how the two could be connected, CERN and Geneva could be connected in that way. And I really believe also very strongly and strategically in how any new initiative has to be really rooted in the place it's at. That's super important because, like a tree, you grow from your roots and then you extend out, and it gives you proper grounding. And then the Arts at CERN program just started opening up doors internationally as well, even more. The Director General talked about how at the beginning he went to WEF and they always think CERN, lots of money, we know what you're doing. And then he went to WEF and said, oh, I'm also got an arts program. And then WEF were like, oh my goodness. And they were really alert and really intrigued. And it gave a different way of CERN being viewed, both locally, nationally, and internationally. So it had all these ripple effects, which were strategically part of my thinking right at the beginning. The top line was always, it's about artists getting the access to fundamental knowledge and having a space to explore and discover, just like physicists, and for the collision of the imagination. That was the top level. But underneath it, there were many different strategic layers to what I was thinking and creating and devising. Yeah. Thank you for spotting that. Well spotted. My goodness, not many people spot that. And it's so lovely to have the opportunity to explain that a bit more.
Now that you've moved on from direct involvement with Arts at CERN, and the project obviously, as we've seen, continued to flourish to the point of winning the 2024 Grand Jury Prize at Ars Electronica. Looking back at what you did there, what were the big lessons for you, the learnings, to use an Americanism?
The learnings. Yes. Gosh, so many learnings as well. I was beginning to think about that and thinking about a list the other day. I suppose one of the top learnings is, gosh, always don't do everything on your own. So literally, I threw my heart, body and soul into the whole project, making it happen. And I was just so determined, and I saw this point at that moment in time where it could happen. I knew I could make it happen. So I literally did work 22 hours a day, fundraising, creating it, making it happen, doing all the different tasks. And luckily, now I'd have a few volunteers who'd help me and some scientists who supported me brilliantly, and the director general who did as well. But I was doing the work and creating it, and it did have a huge impact on my health. So I have come out of that experience with a health issue. So I've learned from that, I hope, now that I've got a chronic health issue, that you should never be quite as driven and determined and do everything as fast as possible, which is what I did. I was so determined. So that's my top learning. Always be careful of your health from that. But then paradoxically, because we're all paradoxes, the other learning is if you can visualize something happening, you can make it happen. And I've always thought that. So that's just reinforced my learning to make things happen. But as I said, I've got to learn from that. You've got to look after your health. Number three, never underestimate how many people you need to work with you on something. Push harder right at the beginning to have help right at the beginning. That obviously links with number one. Arts and sciences, introducing that into a science lab is actually a very sophisticated organizational change program. It's not just an arts and science program. It is an organizational change program, which I actually really love that kind of work, working with organizations to change the way they look at things. But you're doing that on a daily basis. So every day, a scientist or anybody would come up to me and say, why should we have art here? What's this doing here? Why does this have a place? And actually, I loved that. I loved that provocation every day because it made me really think about it and really just constantly engage and constantly work with the organization. So I loved that.
What was your answer to that kind of query? Did you develop an answer? Did you have a kind of boilerplate that you could deal with that sort of query from scientists?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I enjoy challenge. So you can see there's a thread through all this. I enjoy challenge. So there is an answer in the sense that it is a way of exploring and knowing the world, and it's just as valid. It just has different ways of doing it, but equally it can engage and humanize science and the way science looks at the world and bring in different perspectives into an institution where sometimes you can be very linearly focused and not realize that detours can lead you to discoveries, which they have done in the past. They've led to great scientific discoveries, including dreams, like famously Einstein's dreams of the train and dreaming up general relativity from that. So that was kind of vaguely my answer, but obviously my answer did depend on who was asking the question and what their particular approach was. And I always remember one scientist coming up to me going, well, the artist's been here, Julius has been here. And Julius von Bismarck was the first artist on the artist in residency program Collide in 2012. Although I had many visiting artists for 2 years before the Collide program, because I was prototyping what I was doing and how I was creating the introductions and stuff and recruiting scientists. So there were many more artists. There were about 10 a year before that. So I remember this particular scientist saying, my goodness, he's been here for a month and he still hasn't created anything. What is he doing? And I went, so how long did it take you to build your detector? And he went, oh, it took me 15 years. And then I went, so why do you expect the artist to create something in 1 month? And he went away and thought about it. And he said, good point. And so I actually found asking questions back to the scientists was the most effective way of answering their question, because it gave them agency, it gave them space to think through themselves and come to their own realizations, new realizations about things. And I've always found that a very effective method, not telling, but answering with a question, which gives agency to the other. I find scientists respond to that because they are, after all, the investigators of big questions and small questions.
In terms of, again, the relationship with the scientists, it's certainly been my experience working with scientists that they generally are under an enormous amount of time pressure. And even when a scientist is quite interested in this tangential project, they often express inability to give it time because they're so busy with their science. They've got to deliver on outputs. They're working to grants. It's a highly pressured competitive environment that they're in. How did you deal with that? Was that a factor in getting Arts at CERN established, navigating the time pressures of scientists?
Yeah, that's very true. And that was another, as I said, studying the people, place and culture in that 3 months was so fundamental and so important. And yes, I discovered, as you've just said, scientists are very highly pressurized. They're working on very strict deadlines. Even when they're looking at fundamental science, they've got different roadmaps and they've gotten different timelines according to their funding, everything. So they're working really hard. And obviously everyone's chasing and wanting a discovery. And that may take years, but the faster you run, the faster you may get there. So what I discovered was that the way to enlist scientists and get them involved is the famous lunch break and coffee break. So making those introductions and enabling those conversations to happen in the lunch breaks, absolutely fundamental and absolutely key to that, and the coffee breaks. So I was really working around all those. And then once they get, sounds terrible, it's like trapping fish, really. Once they get intrigued and involved, then of course, any human being, when your curiosity is piqued, you've started getting really involved, you do give time and you always find time. As they often say anyway, the more important somebody is, the more they will find time if there's something they're curious about. So that's how I worked it. As well as having some lead scientists who were brilliant in really coming on board right at the beginning and being ambassadors, like the experimental physicist Michael Dozer, who's an expert in antimatter. He was incredibly important in supporting me in the early days, as well as other physicists who were inside the institution, like Stephen Goldfarb, for example. They were all very key. Despina, who worked at Alice, who was incredible. And Fabiola, in her early days, was very, very supportive of the program as well, which she is still, because otherwise it wouldn't be existing.
Strategic allies. And it seemed to me another important innovation in your design was recognizing that there needed to be a physical infrastructure for the project. And particularly you included in that a studio for the artists to work in, as opposed to trying to do their art in the lab and getting in the way of whatever science was happening in the lab.
Ooh, a slight correction on both those things. Number one, the studio, in inverted commas, was literally an office where a physicist would be. So they were inside a typical physicist's office. So they became part of the culture, part of the space. So they had a blackboard, a desk, and a computer. That's exactly what a physicist has. That's it. So I wouldn't really call it a studio, if only. That would be another evolution to have studios on site. And the other thing I'm just correcting is I'm afraid I did interfere with the science. So, so for example, you know, you've got 12,000 physicists on site and you've got one artist. How do you make their presence felt? So in those early days, I created interventions in the space. So, for example, one day, Julius von Bismarck and I kidnapped 14 physicists, blindfolded them,
Yes, I read about that. That was delightful. You survived that and weren't expelled from, you know, the CERN premises. I thought it was noteworthy. Tell us about that kidnapping of the scientists.
No, there are many other things as well we did. And I really loved these interventions. Well, we did advertise for volunteers to be kidnapped. And then they came to the room. We blindfolded everybody and then took just 14 of them, blindfolded, down underground below the building, the main building. And the week before, Julius and I had spent a week walking in these dark passages, which are totally in the dark. There's no light. And we'd mapped it out like bats in our heads. So we knew where all the spaces were. And then we planted the physicists in this space. They were wandering around and then asked them to reflect on the invisible, what they saw in their mind's eye at that particular point. What were they seeing, these great investigators? Then we recorded it. And that recording's never come out, but we do have it. Yeah, so that's a bit of a kind of surrealist intervention. Yeah, another time, the day before they were announcing the LHC discovery of the Higgs boson, we rigged the tree outside Restaurant One with microphones, hid them in the tree. So the tree was eavesdropping on the physicists' conversations, another artwork which has not been released. And another time, Gilles Jobin and I, we actually took over Restaurant One, which is the hallowed space where all the physicists meet. The physicists came down for lunch and found it had turned into a dance floor and that there were dancers dancing in their hallowed space. And then they all sat round and watched it. And another time we intervened inside the CERN library. And his artists went in, again, it wasn't announced, went in and started threading themselves through bookshelves and moving books and then piling books and creating these giant structures and sculptures. And there's a very famous photograph of Gilles doing a kind of tumble in front of a physicist with one of his dancers. And he actually wrote a note saying, "Hello," which he left on the physicist's desk. And the physicist just didn't notice. So there's this photograph of the physicist really working and focusing and the dancer really focusing on tumbling and leaving a note saying hello. And that went all over the media, which again was a great example of the concentration and focus of artists with that of scientists. So I'm afraid we did disrupt the science. We even turned the LHC into a musical instrument. I did that with Bill Fontana. The LHC was not switched on, otherwise we would have all been evaporated and dead, but it was when it was not switched on and we turned it into the world's largest musical instrument by attaching an accelerometer to it and playing back the sound of the particles leaving the tiny bottle at the beginning of the LHC journey. It's a bottle the size of a Coke bottle, and the particles which whiz around this 26-kilometer machine originate from there. And we got the sound of that from accelerometers. And then we put accelerometers on the LHC and played it back to itself. So it went back to its origins. So I'm afraid I did do a bit of interruption.
But clearly the scientific community was tolerant of these interventions and disruptions.
They were. They became, I mean, there was an article in Nature which said it was like there was a new nightclub in town. I mean, everybody was really excited about it because it was new adventures and you just didn't know what was really going to happen. And also it was just such a great way, as I said, of making the artist's presence felt within the institution. 12,000 people. I mean, how many buildings are there at CERN? There are about 800 buildings. So how do you make that presence felt? But equally, there were other ways like lectures, which we did, much more formal things where we did public lectures open to the public as well as the lab at the beginning and the end of the residency inside the globe, which is the kind of centre at CERN.
Which reminds me of Ale de Puente, her first residency. She did that project at CERN called Finding the Centre.
Yes, exactly, because where is the center?
Yeah, nobody knew. And she got all the scientists to think about this, you know, where is the center in CERN? And the very different answers that they came up with. And her finally discovering the geographical center, which I think was in a field, which is still being cultivated above the main collider machinery. And that was the center. And then there were the ideas of the center, which different scientists had. And she constructed this geography, I suppose, imaginative topology of this great scientific research center, the center of the center. We could talk for a long time. I can see that. It's a pity I don't have kind of Joe Rogan type time frame. But I really do want to ask you to talk about what I think is your later position, your insistence that we need to go beyond the acceptance of art science as de facto positive. And what does this mean for your work in science technology? How are you engaging with that realization? So if you can just unpack that a bit and then, as a way of concluding our discussion, talk about what are your directions projects that you're working on now.
Yes, I've written a paper and discussed how art and science shouldn't be taken at face value as being de facto positive, as you've said, that actually we have to look beneath it and look at the power structures underneath art and science, that they're not devoid of power structures, they're not neutral. So, for example, if you look at the whole history of science, you can look at it through a lens where it's got a very strong colonial aspect to it and domination. If you look at, for example, quantum physics, I'm always amazed. The ideas of quantum physics have existed in older cultures, ancient wisdoms, for thousands of years. So why do we need science to prove what older wisdoms have always said and known? And there's a very famous series of discussions by a American native Indian with a physicist. There's a whole series of discussions about that. They've been happening since about the mid-1960s, and they're very interesting to read. So there's a very strong colonial and aspect of domination, and I think that needs to be redressed. I do think science needs to be much more open to thinking potentially that science is not just the science we know from the Enlightenment, that science is actually a way of knowing. So going back to its original naming, you also can see how science eradicated the idea of subjectivity from it by creating methodology and saying we have methodology which is objective. And then it tried to eradicate imagination because of that. And now we're accepting much more that imagination is part of science, which means subjectivity is much more part of science. So we have to be more open about that. But equally, art has its own power games which happen inside it, which are starting very, 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 very tiny bits to unravel. You've obviously got the commercial market, but equally again, you've got inequality as to what is recognized as contemporary art, by whom and what kind of art is promoted and accepted and shown in museums. So I think we have to be really, really mindful of everything and really think that through. And that's probably what my work is doing at the moment. I do a lot of that work. I've just written a paper which will be published later this year, which is hilarious because I did a show called Entangle, Physics and the Artistic Imagination, and was really into entanglement. And I am still really into thinking about quantum physics, but equally, like anything, I think we have to beware when things become orthodoxies and become fixed, and we do need to challenge them and have a much more holistic awareness, both societally, ethically, culturally, socially.
Let me ask you about one other observation that I've certainly made working with artists and scientists and coming myself from the creative arts side is I've been astonished how often scientists use the word beautiful. Often in scientists' talk, they use the word beautiful in talking about equations, in talking about particular experiments, and talking about insights that they're beautiful, there's beauty there. Yet that's a phrase that is almost entirely absent from contemporary art discourse. You know, contemporary art discourse, it's transgressive, it's disruptive. But beauty has been, I think, quite successfully expunged from the discourse of contemporary art, probably going way back to sort of the ends of modernism. Is that something you've observed? And why do you think that is? What does that mean about these as modes of knowledge and apprehension?
Oh, gosh, that's a big question again. And that's a discussion point which could go on forever. Obviously, beauty for scientists and physicists means something completely different, though, from what we think it is in terms of from a creative and artistic point of view. It's a completely different aesthetic. It's an aesthetic which works on a very different level and is very closely related to elegance in mathematical formulations. And this kind of shows how really art and science language is a metaphor, basically. And we're all working in this kind of funny act of translation where nothing connects but does connect at the same time. So as I said, a scientist's view of elegance and beauty is very different from the beauty within contemporary art. There is still beauty in contemporary art, and sometimes that beauty can also be triggered inside the imagination of the viewer. And I think that's something which can happen even in the most conceptual of contemporary art, where it triggers beauty inside that. But then last weekend, I was at Troika's opening at the Langen Foundation. They famously work with science and technology. And they're contemporary artists. They're French, German by origin. There are three of them. They're based in London. And that show was beautiful. It was inside a Japanese architectural building, but that was aesthetically extraordinary. And I'm still living with that aesthetic experience. So I don't think aesthetic has been expunged out of contemporary art. I think there's more intellect going into contemporary art. And yes, there's disruption as well, but you can still have that. I mean, even the sculptures which they did, which are literally composite sculptures, which take different bits of sculptures from antelope's head to a Rodin sculpture and then mix them all up and fix them all on top of each other. You could say they're very ugly, but they're also extremely beautiful, lying in water with reflections and light off them. So I kind of take exception because I think contemporary art still has its beauty. But as I said, the beauty between the two is very different. It's very different. I wish I was a scientist because I could then understand. I've got a feeling of what they mean by beauty and elegance. It must be something to do with dimensionality because they're always talking about the dimensions of numbers and looking beyond.
No, thank you for that. I think your answer makes a lot of sense to me, but it's just something that has really struck me how often I hear that phrase. Ariane, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Christo.
You've been listening to a dialogue between myself, Christo Doherty, the Chair of Research in the Wits School of Arts, and my guest, the British independent producer, curator, and writer, Ariane Cook. This podcast was hosted and produced by myself, with technical production by Elna Schutz. The music for this podcast was composed and performed by Lee Rosevere and is used under a Creative Commons license.